Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our fourth and final look at the Oakland County child killings. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, like the show, and leave a five-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content. All right, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt.
When we left off last time, we had been discussing the primary suspects in this case. Gregory Green, a convicted pedophile who ends up dying in prison in the 1990s, and his partner in crime, son of wealthy general managers, executive H. Lee Bush, Christopher Bush, who ends up dying under suspicious circumstances in his parents' home while no one is around from a reported suicide. Many people don't believe that Bush's death was a suicide. Many think that it was in fact a murder to cover up or to clean up loose ends as far as Bush is concerned, as the North Fox Island story had broken right around the time that Bush ends up getting arrested for sexually abusing young boys. Bush had ties to the North Fox Island ring, and these people believe that he was killed simply to keep his mouth shut. There are other suspects and persons of interest in this case, however, that have come to light in the last decade or so that we really need to shine a spotlight on. I do want to state, though, we may get into a touch of conspiracy theory in this episode. I try and avoid that where I can. Obviously, if you've listened to this show for a while, you know that I try and cover every facet of a case possible when I do a deep dive, such as when I covered Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombing. There were so many different loose ends that people constantly talk about that I have to bring these up if I'm going to be a completist when covering a case. So keep that in mind as we move forward. Some of this stuff is in the realm of that dirty word, conspiracy theory, as it's a belief held by many, but not supported completely by facts or by law enforcement. Just prior to Christopher Bush committing suicide or being murdered on November 20th, 1978, a Berkeley police officer by the name of Christopher Flynn ends up being found dead. This was on November 14th. Now, Flynn worked the night shift at the Berkeley Police Department, and when he does not turn up for work that evening, someone is sent to go check at him. At 12:40 a.m., Flynn is found slumped over the steering wheel of his station wagon, which is listed as a 1973 Buick Skylark, which was located at the La Salente Catholic Church in downtown Berkeley. There are two guns found in the car with Flynn along with his body. There was a .357 Magnum revolver in Flynn's right hand and a .44 caliber handgun lying on the passenger seat of his car. Now, whether this was a revolver or a pistol is not listed in any paperwork that I could found. However, it does state in the police report that the .357 belonged to Christopher Flynn, while the 44 belonged to another officer, James E. Crussell. Flynn is found to have died from multiple gunshot wounds, and according to police, it's believed that he shot himself first with the 357, and when that did not work, he used Crussell's 44 Magnum to finish the job. Now, this is odd in a number of regards, particularly the fact that we have this 44 Magnum lying on the passenger seat. There is no valid explanation as to why Flynn was still holding the gun that the cops thought he shot himself with first, and the other gun is on the passenger seat, the one that they believe he finished himself off with. You would think that if he shot himself with one gun, it didn't kill him. He decides to use the other one. He would drop the first gun before picking the second one up, and that is the one which would be found in his hand. The people close to this case who point to this death as being extremely suspicious point out these facts, as well as a number of other things. Now, prior to his death, someone had called into a tip to the Oakland County Child Killing Task Force. This was on May 11th, 1977, and it's theorized that this, coupled with the fact that Flynn had divorced from his wife 2 years previously, led him to taking his own life, as well as reports that Flynn had been sexually abused as a child by a priest. Now, this last one cannot be verified, so we have to take this with a grain of salt. Really, the only things that make Flynn's death noteworthy is his time of death, the fact that he dies so close to Christopher Bush's dying, and the fact that he was called into the task force once in 1977, but then again in 1979, after he had died, when a woman calls in a tip about Flynn, inquiring about his manner of death. Now, we don't have anything concrete stating what this woman was told by officers or what information she was able to provide, other than the fact that she did call in a tip on Christopher Flynn. As stated earlier, Bush ends up committing suicide on November 20th. Then there isn't a lot of news concerning the case at all. Not that there wasn't anything going on. The police are still ostensibly investigating the crimes, but there's not a lot of new information being gleaned from anything, at least not that is being made public. In 1978, an individual we discussed during the first episode of this series, Arch Sloan, ends up being arrested. Now, if you'll recall, Arch Sloan was the convicted pedophile who ends up contacting the police the night that Stebbins goes missing to let them know that he is working late at the auto mechanic shop where he is employed, and that if they see the lights on, they don't need to stop and inquire about what's going on. Some people have felt that this was extremely suspicious, and given this guy's history, I agree that it was. It should be noted, though, that officers in the town of Berkeley very often would stop when they would see lights on in a building at night that they did not expect to be on. So Sloan had been working as an auto mechanic and coaching youth baseball, and at some point he began sexually assaulting two brothers aged 12 and 14. arrested on December 12, 1978, and Sloan will be charged with further abuses against children. Sloan ends up getting an 18-month sentence for the rape of the two brothers. However, he's already serving another sentence for a different rape that he had committed in 1978. So the judge gives him 3 years of probation with 214 days time already served on all of this from the other conviction that he had received. What this means is that Arch Sloan is going to be able to go out and commit further crimes. Concurrent with all of this going on, the task force has been dropping hints in local media that they believe the person responsible for the Oakland County child murders has been institutionalized by their family, and there's never really any real hardcore evidence given as to why the task force believes this to be true. They simply put it out there through multiple media outlets that the killer is more probably than not being held in a mental institution. And with this knowledge, on December 15th of 1978, the task force officially dissolves, listing the case as unsolved and probably unsolvable on the theory that the killer is probably in a mental institution. Police department will continue to put out the idea that the killer is institutionalized through March of 1980, stating on a number of occasions that the killer probably comes from a wealthy family, and that this wealthy family that had them institutionalized, although we're never given an idea as to who this individual might be, or how the task force came to this conclusion. Many tied to this case theorize that this was an allusion to Christopher Bush. Moving into the 1980s, a couple of books come out. Works of fiction that people very close to this case, specifically family members of the slain boys, believe points to not only Christopher Bush, but also to a cover-up by the police. One of these books came out in January of 1980. It's called The Oakland County Child Killer by Michael L. Parent. The book is littered with allusions to suspects who, at that point in time, were not known to the public, as well as to very specific areas where it's believed by police that the killer or killers there are pieces in the newspaper and on the news about these still unsolved crimes, with representatives from law enforcement making statements here and there, but nothing really comes of anything, at least publicly. On October 1st, Arch Sloan is arrested yet again. Now, by this point in time, Sloan had been living in a trailer at the abandoned Packard plant in Hamtramck. Now, if you've ever seen images of this plant, it's exactly what you envision. It's a great big automobile factory that has long been abandoned. There is a central courtyard inside of it that is overgrown, littered with trash, and it's in this central courtyard that Sloan is living inside of this trailer. There's a lot of other crimes going on at this plant, from drug abuse. I've read some accounts that some murders may have taken place there, rapes, etc., etc. It's a very detached, desolate place where Arch Sloan is, at least for a period of time, able to operate with impunity. Basically, what Sloan was doing was he was going out and getting young boys and bringing them back to this trailer and raping them. And as before, some of these victims are the children of co-workers of Sloan's. In fact, this one that he is arrested for on October 1st is a 10-year-old son of one of his co-workers. From everything that I can find, Sloan ends up sitting in jail for over a year before going to trial. In January of 1985, where a psychiatrist states that Sloan is, quote, only capable of sexual satisfaction with small children. And on the 29th of January 1985, Arch Sloan gets sentenced to life in prison, with the judge stating he should never be allowed in society again. Now, some information that does not come up during his trial, which, again, people close to this case point to as basis for the idea that there was and still is a conspiracy of either active participation or a conspiracy of silence surrounding the Oakland County child killers, is this. According to the Detroit Police Department files concerning Arch Sloan's arrest, officers stated that Sloan had been on the run in the months prior to his October 1983 arrest, and that he may have been aided and abetted by a Detroit police officer by the name of Richard Clayton, who may have used his property in Montmorency County, known as El Rancho Farm, as a place to hide Sloan. Now, in his 1978 conviction, it's listed that this property, this El Rancho Farm, is one of the areas that Arch Sloan had taken victims to rape them. We have no information to indicate what Sloan's relationship may have been with the officer, whether the officer was aware of the crimes that Sloan had committed or was committing on his property, or why this individual may have chosen to allow Sloan to hide out on his property. We only have notes inside of the police file, which, again, given the high tempers in this case, that type of information is going to find fertile ground in the minds of those who have been affected so terribly by this series of murders. We're going to shift gears a little bit now and look at another suspect. And the jumping around like this is because there's a number of different suspects, all of whom it appears knew one another and were known to the task force at the time of the crimes. However, none of them came to public attention until the 2000s as possibly being involved. Our next suspect is an individual by the name of Robert Lloyd Bailey. Bailey was born February 21st, 1959 in Detroit, Michigan, and by his own accounts, he never got along with his parents, stating that his father was a very strict and emotionally distant man, while his mother was extremely domineering. Bailey would later tell psychologists that he was sexually molested by an older man as a youth, and had a homosexual encounter when he was in the third grade. Now, in 1972, Bailey ends up being admitted to a psychiatric hospital for kidnapping and molesting a young boy who he had seen riding his bicycle in Farmington. Keep in mind that at this point in time, Bailey's only 13. The next year, he abducts a 15-year-old off of his bike, ties him up, and then sexually assaults him, all using a knife to threaten the young boy. On June 12, 1974, he uses a knife again to kidnap and molest a 12-year-old. All of this results in Bailey being committed to the psychiatric hospital in Detroit yet again. It's stated by Bailey that he was a model prisoner and in fact engaged in a sexual relationship with a female nurse who was 10 years older than he was. Being released, Bailey, now 16 in 1975, abducts a 10-year-old boy, drugs him, and nearly chokes the child to death in the course of sexually assaulting him. Bailey is again sent back to the psychiatric hospital after being convicted. While at this hospital, Bailey is discovered sexually assaulting another patient, at which point he promptly flees the psychiatric hospital, only to be recaptured and sent to the Northville Regional Psychiatric Hospital, where his psychologist, Dr. Jose Tombo, who is going to end up being convicted of sexual assaults himself after it is discovered that he is drugging and raping his patients, notes that Bailey is making considerable progress, this in 1977. Should be noted, though, that this same doctor physically caught Bailey stealing drugs from the pharmacy inside the psychiatric hospital, and later caught him attempting to sexually proposition another male patient. This doctor stated that the things that Bailey was doing were part of a normal, healthy growth pattern. Not long after this, Bailey ends up getting released from this psychiatric hospital on the recommendation of Dr. Tombo. We know that Bailey is not incarcerated during the roughly 18-month span that the Oakland County child murders are taking place. Some sources state that he was continuing with therapy as well as on parole during this period of time. However, his exact movements, what he may or may not have been getting into, at least to those of us in the public, remain unknown. We do know that in early 1980, he ends up moving to Florida, where he stays until spring of 1983. Bailey lives with a friend while he's down there working at a tire shop. We do know from his own statements later that up being arrested in May of 1983 after officers encountering him demanding that a 14-year-old boy perform oral sex on him, at which point Bailey promptly flees Florida and returns to Michigan. Once back in Michigan, Bailey gets a job working at a coffee store and very quickly is back into committing the same types of crimes. So in June of 1984, Bailey is arrested and charged with kidnapping and sexually assaulting a 15-year-old boy. Now, unbeknownst to police, during this period of time, there are other victims out there who Bailey has assaulted. While he's awaiting trial for the sexual assault, Bailey kidnaps a 14-year-old by the name of Kenneth Myers. Bailey had lured the young boy away from a parking lot near his home, at which point he kidnaps the boy, sexually assaults him, and then strangles him to death. We don't have a disposition for the sexual assault cases against Bailey from this period of time. What we do know is that on August 31st, 1985, he asked a young boy to go fishing with him, and the boy's mother adamantly refused to allow her son to go fishing with Bailey, as this was going to be a weekend trip. According to Bailey, he asked numerous people to go fishing with him, all of whom refused. Angry about this, Bailey ends up getting into his Jeep Wrangler and just starts driving around, drinking beer and smoking weed, stopping by people's homes, going to parties that he's not invited to. Eventually, Bailey ends up at a convenience store in Brighton, Michigan, where he goes in to purchase a pack of cigarettes and sees a 13-year-old boy by the name of Sean Moore. Moore is outside the store, standing next to his bicycle, drinking a soda when Bailey goes inside. Leaving the convenience store, Bailey continues to drive around, and again, he sees Sean Moore riding his bike down the road. Bailey decides to pull up alongside the boy. Feigning to ask for directions, Bailey steps out from the vehicle and begins to talk to Sean before suddenly changing tactics completely, grabbing Moore and throwing him inside of the Jeep. Obviously, Moore is flipping out. Bailey threatens to stab the young boy if he does not acquiesce to his demands. After this, Bailey drives to Gladwin County, where there is a cabin. Now, reports vary as to who actually owned this cabin. Some reports state that this was actually Bailey's cabin. Others that the cabin actually belonged to his girlfriend. In any case, what ends up happening is Bailey spends the rest of the day at the cabin with Sean Moore, drinking beer and getting high, offering both alcohol and drugs to the young boy before cooking the two of them dinner and deciding that it was time to bed down for the night. Now, according to Bailey, at this point, he had not sexually assaulted Sean. However, that would change the next day when he proceeds to rape Sean Moore. Afterwards, he strangles Sean, first with his hands and then with a belt. According to Bailey, he fell asleep long after this and awoke the next day to see Sean Moore's body lying there and completely panicked, realizing that he had taken the boy's life. At which point, Bailey disposes of Sean's body in some nearby woods, covering him with leaves. Now, unbeknownst to Bailey, people had seen him speaking to the young boy and kidnapping him. This witness had contacted the police, who very quickly released a sketch of the vehicle as well as the individual seen speaking to Sean. reaction to learning that their son had been kidnapped. On September 3rd, a command post ends up being set up once the parents are cleared. And this is in a Brighton warehouse, and a reward is offered. Concurrent with all of this, the FBI gets involved, and fairly quickly, tips start coming in implicating Ronald Bailey. He is questioned by authorities. Bailey claims to have an alibi for the date in question of August 31st, stating that he was out fishing with a friend on that day. However, then police receive another tip, this one from a police officer who had had dealings with Bailey in the past and was very well apprised of Bailey's past criminal history, specifically the violent kidnapping and sexual assaults for which Bailey had repeatedly been incarcerated for. So now the police are out looking for Bailey, however, they are unaware that he has fled the state, returning to Florida, specifically the Orlando region. Now, a suspect, they can't question him, they have no idea where he's at. On September 13th, Sean Moore's body is discovered near the cabin that Bailey was known to have used. And unfortunately, Sean is in an advanced state of decomposition, and police officially name Bailey as the prime suspect, issuing an arrest warrant for him. The following day, Bailey is located in Orlando, Florida, and is arrested without incident. Once back in Michigan, Bailey readily admits to having murdered both Sean Moore and Kenneth Myers. At trial, Bailey pleads insanity, stating that the molestation he had undergone as a child had led him to molest other boys as well as to commit two counts of murder. Bailey is going to end up receiving two life sentences, which he is still currently serving. And in 2007, the police working the cold case of the Oakland County child killings actually start interviewing Bailey, questioning whether he may not have been responsible or have been involved with the Oakland child killings. My major issue with that is that we know that the victims were kept alive for a period of time, and during the period of time when these crimes were committed, to the best of everyone's knowledge, Bailey had no access to an area in which he could keep his victims. More than that, from what we know of the Oakland County child murders, the MO is massively different from the crimes which Bailey was convicted of. In every single one, Bailey simply grabs the child and does what he's going to do with them, and then he either releases them, is caught, or murders them by strangulation. Given his age, the fact that there are two known female victims, and the fact that Bailey's crimes appear to have been impulse-driven, whereas the series of murders that we're looking at seem to have had thought put into him, there was a higher degree of intelligence present in the Oakland County child killings. An effort was made to conceal detection, whereas Bailey, he's really a disorganized offender. I'm not saying that both of these individuals did not strike when the opportunity arose, but Bailey, just by what County child killer was not. Also, the manner of disposal. We don't know who disposed of the bodies with the Oakland County child killings because no one saw the bodies being disposed of. They were not located in an area close to where any of the known suspects are known to have lived. Bailey's final victim was found very close to the cabin that he had taken the child to, a cabin which could only be tied back to him. So he really is not a viable suspect in any way, shape, or form, but there are a few others that are. One of whom is an individual by the name of Richard Lawson. Now, Lawson was a known pedophile in Detroit. He operated along the Cass Corridor, which, as discussed in previous episodes, is a low-income area of Detroit that is and was rife with crime, child prostitution, as well as child exploitation. So Lawson was known to operate in this Cass Corridor during the 1970s. He actually ends up becoming a police informant, and a lot of information out there states that when he was made an informant, the police actually gave him a badge, which Lawson would use in order to force children into his vehicle, at which point he would drive them away and sexually assault them. During this point in time, there was a child pornography ring operating in the Cass Corridor. All indications are that it was largely run by an individual by the name of Bobby Moore, also known as Bad Eye Bob. Bobby Moore had a bicycle shop that, similar to the infamous Different Strokes episode where Arnold and Dudley end up at a bike shop that is operated by a pedophile, he would entice children into the back room, at which point he would sexually assault them, he would invite others to sexually assault them, and child pornography was created involving these children. There was also a house located along the Cass Corridor where individuals would go for parties, usually on weekends, where victims would be brought, and it would, pardon this expression, but basically be a rape party where men would take turns with the various boys at these parties. We know now that, at least according to some individuals active during this period of time, much of the activity as far as child abuse films was funded by Francis Sheldon. Now, some of this information comes to an individual we just spoke about, Richard Lawson. By the 1980s, Lawson was no longer a police informant, and in fact was well known to police for assaulting young boys. By September of 1988, Lawson is sitting in the Macomb County Jail awaiting trial on 4 counts of sexual assault of young boys. While sitting in jail, Richard Lawson contacts Barry King, that is Timothy King's father, and tells him that he has information about the Oakland County child killings. So Barry King, along with 2 Birmingham detectives, go to the Macomb County Jail and begin questioning Lawson about what he knows, with Lawson stating that he will only give information if he is given immunity from prosecution. Why is this important? Well, the charges Lawson was facing, these 4 counts of child sexual assault, are dismissed. However, I don't believe that these charges are what Lawson was asking for immunity. from, more likely than not. Given the information he gives law enforcement, he was asking for immunity should they proceed with charges against any of the individuals involved in the Oakland County child murders. Now, Lawson states that he was a police informant during the 1970s and that law enforcement would look the other way anytime Lawson did anything, so long as he turned in others who were committing similar acts, something that the head of the Child Sex Crimes Unit at the time has repeatedly denied happened. Although, we know that this type of thing was not only very commonplace back then, but even takes place now where prosecutors and members of law enforcement will allow an individual to commit the crimes that they are doing, or at least act as though they have no knowledge of it, provided that the snitch or the informant gives them viable information with which they can make arrests, which then lead to conviction. Now, Lawson refused to name any names, but he gave a list of three individuals that he identified by numbers as persons that the police needed to track down and speak to in regards to the Oakland County child killings. The first individual's name has never been identified. Lawson stated that this individual was a gambler who frequented poker games in the Highland Park area, sold large quantities of cocaine, and would procure children for other individuals to abuse. The second individual that Lawson named was the aforementioned Bobby Moore, who Lawson stated made films in an apartment on the Cass Corridor and whose films were financed by Francis Sheldon. The last individual that Lawson named ended up being a person by the name of Ted Lamborghini, who we are going to get to shortly. According to Lawson, this individual had worked for the Ford Motor Company and had ended up moving out of Michigan years earlier. When asked why Timothy King may have been inducted, Lawson stated that it's most likely that Francis Sheldon had a need for a child who matched Timothy King's description for use in his abuse videos, and thus he was taken. It's interesting to note here that Lawson stated all of this. We know from one victim that in all probability, Timothy King was forced to have sex with another boy in the presence of Christopher Bush, and that after this sexual encounter was completed, Timothy King was passed on to another man who this other boy was not able to identify. We don't know if he has since been able to make an identification, but to the best of my knowledge, this has not taken place. So after all of this, Lawson ends up working as a cab driver for the Detroit Cab Company. On June 19th, 1989, Lawson and one of his pedophilic victims, Richard Maduka, age 16, waited in a car across the street from Lawson's employer, Xavier Giller's home. The idea was that Lawson knew that Giller brought home large amounts of money with him from the cab company, and after waiting for a period of time, had committed this crime until 2005, when police received a tip that Richard Lawson had been involved. And on January 26th, he is arrested in San Diego, California, on his way to meet with his probation officer. How all of this ended up happening is this. An officer was looking into the Oakland County child killings. He came across Lawson's name in them. Researching Lawson, he discovered he had been arrested in 1989 in Pennsylvania, of all places. And that during the course of speaking with police, he offered them information on what he dubbed the snow killings if they could offer him a reduced sentence. Obviously, the police, looking into Lawson during this period of time, are intrigued by all of this, and Lawson ends up coming into their grasp when an informant lets them know that Lawson was probably responsible for the murder of Giller back in 1989. Lawson's tracked down, he's arrested, he starts talking to the police, and expands a little on what he told them back when he initially spoke to them in 1988. However, one piece of evidence that he did tell them was that an individual by the name of Ted Orr, real name Ted Lamborghini, needed to be spoken to. He also told the officers that there were two pedophiles who ran together during this period of time, and one of them liked boys, the other liked girls. However, he never elaborated on this, and Lawson ends up dying in prison in 2012. Armed with all of this information, officers begin looking for Ted Lamborghini. And they eventually track him down. This is later in 2005 in Parma Heights, Ohio, where Lamborghini is pulled over and informed that police in Michigan want to have a word with him. According to the arresting officer, Lamborghini is reported to have said, quote, "I knew my past would catch up with me." Over the course of a 3-hour interrogation, Lamborghini admits to having known numerous pedophiles during the 1970s and to having sexually abused hundreds of boys. However, he states emphatically that he had nothing to do with any of the killings and had no information that was pertinent to those crimes. Interestingly, Lamborghini was never arrested for any of these crimes that he did commit up until he has his run-in with authorities in 2005. He's also known to have left Detroit in 1978. While an exact date is not given, it's implied in investigator notes that he left sometime shortly after the murders had concluded. On January 1st of 2006, the Oakland County child murders are reopened. In July of that year, an individual tells a polygrapher named Patrick Coffey that he had polygraphed Timothy King's killer. This occurs at a conference in Las Vegas, although the man who claims is said to have made this statement, Larry Wasser, has claimed he never made this statement, although later he would negotiate an agreement with the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office where he would help them locate the name of this individual he supposedly interviewed in exchange for not having to testify in court. Of interest in all of this, according to Patrick Coffey, when pressed for information about the killer's identity, Wasser would only state that both the individual responsible and their lawyer has never spoken about the crimes, either publicly or privately, to the best of my knowledge. The investigation did not end with Ted Lamborghini, however. Officers reviewed the polygraphs administered during the course of the murders, and that's when it's discovered that Bush had actually failed his polygraph examination. So they bring in one of Bush's victims, Vince Gunnels, and he blows the polygraph by holding his breath the entire time that he is doing it in order to throw off any results that might come from his answering the questions. In October of 2008, the former Bush family residence is searched by police, and while it's stated that they found massive amounts of physical evidence, none of it has ever officially been logged. In 2009, a hair found on Kristen Milik's jacket is matched to Vic Gunnels. However, Gunnels, who was on parole in Butte, Montana during this point in time, insists that he was not present during the course of the crime. In investigators' notes, it states, quote, reading him his rights and explaining that the task force is now in possession of DNA that was located on the shirt of Kristen Milich. Sergeant Gray tried to show Gunnels a picture of Milich while explaining the DNA. Gunnels would not look at the photo and continued to sit back in his chair with his eyes closed, listening. Gunnels did not deny anything, but simply said that he wants an attorney and he's not saying anything without one. In a telephone conversation recorded from the jail with his sister, Gunnels is recorded as saying, quote, I wasn't there when it happened, and in a later excerpt when discussing his brother, he's quoted as saying, quote, if it comes down to it, he's gonna have to show his face up in court one day to me. So what does this hair mean? It means that Kristen was in an area where either Gunnels or an extremely close family relative, like a sister or brother, was present. More likely than not, either a vehicle or a home. Now, we know that Vic Gunnels spent a great deal of time in Christopher Bush's vehicle, so it could well be that he was in this vehicle at some point in time, and the hair transferred from the car to Kristen's body. It could also be that somebody else related to these crimes was in Kristen's presence, or was it in an area where she herself was at. Unfortunately, unless there is further DNA development, we get a smoking gun, or somebody confesses or pins these crimes on another, we will likely never fully know the extent of anything involving this crime, or how Vic Gunnels or one of his relatives' hairs ended up on one of the victims. Now, there is another individual who one woman has put forth as being the killer. She says the man admitted to her over dinner in a restaurant that he had committed the crimes. However, I have seen no evidence to put after Mark Stebbins was found dead. Should be noted, however, that to date, this hair has not been linked to either Sloan or any of his known associates. In other news concerning Arch Sloan and showing the unreliability of polygraphs, Arch Sloan fails a polygraph in 2010. However, he passed a very similar polygraph in February of 1976. Starting in July of 2015, individuals start to come forward claiming to have been victims of a pedophilia ring operating from the 1970s, at least until the mid-1980s, that was made up of General Motors executives. One of these individuals being Christopher Bush's father, H. Lee Bush. However, other than these individual statements, no evidence has arisen to support this. There is a story out there as well that the man who was the first responding officer to the Bush home was himself a pedophile who routinely molested children inside of his patrol car. This individual, Richard McNamee, was arrested in the early 1980s on charges of child sexual abuse. The last two bits, Vince Gunnels jumps bail in October of 2020 as he was facing 3 to 23 years for selling methamphetamine. And finally, on November 19th of 2020, Timothy King's father, Barry King, dies at the age of 89. As of the recording of this episode, there have been no new suspects or leads in the Oakland County child murders. And some family members believe that during their original investigation, there was much being covered up by authorities. They believe that this is still the case. While I cannot say that that is in fact reality, I can say that there's a lot of shady shit going on in Detroit. To the best of my knowledge, other than the Atlanta child murders, I cannot recall an area where I have covered a case that had such a widespread, seemingly well-known about problem with pedophile rings. And unless the individual who committed these murders was operating separately from these rings, I find it highly dubious that anyone who was either not known to the police or who was not in some capacity tied to this